probably occurred to most of us by now that Christmas is round the corner. Have you woken up to that fact? I'm just getting used to the idea. We have a lovely family tradition in our family. That's the 11 members of our immediate family. We try to get together sometime between Christmas and the New Year. And we sit round the table and include all the teenage grandchildren. And we ask ourselves two questions. And everybody around the table has to answer those two questions. Question number one is, what has been your greatest achievement in the last 12 months? I took a lot of flack last year because I said my greatest achievement was the quality of my compost. And quite a number of you, for the first time ever, I didn't have to buy in any compost. I grew all my seedlings in my own homemade compost, and quite a lot of you got tomatoes from that compost, and they were good, weren't they? But the second question that we ask ourselves is, what lessons have you learned in the last 12 months? And actually, it's a good question to ask as we look at what Malachi has to say. What lessons have I learned in the last 12 months? Last year, when we had that discussion round our table in our home, we ended up with a fascinating discussion amongst the family about punishment and about how punishment should be meted out and how it should be handled. And we all remembered a very significant incident in our family history when our youngest son was just 6 years old. He was 6 years and 1 month. And at primary school, he used to come home with his brother, and for me, almost the best part of the day was when the three of us would sit down on the sofa every evening and share a packet of crisps and tell each other our news. And on one particular occasion, Philip, our youngest son, age six, just couldn't join in. He was distracted, he was nervous, he was irritable, and he wouldn't say what the problem was. But there it was, we didn't push it. Next morning he went, somewhat reluctantly, but definitely to school. And I thought, let's hope it's sorted out. But he came back from school that evening when I got home, and he was much worse. He was really irritable and worried and cross and just couldn't cope with family life. And immediately after supper, he took himself off to bed. That was unusual. I didn't watch any television, just went upstairs. And twice during the evening, I heard him crying quietly in his bedroom. And I thought, oh, golly, what's the trouble? But next morning, he got up very early and said, I want to go to school, Dad. And the thing came out, what was causing the hassle. At the primary school where he was with his brother, there was a sweet shop just a short distance down the road. And that sweet shop did a roaring trade, you could imagine, at the end of each school day. But it was a very strict school rule that the kids were not allowed to go to the sweet shop during the school day. And Phil had been caught by the deputy head in the sweet shop at lunchtime. Strictly illegal. And the head had wagged his finger, deputy head had wagged his finger at him and said, Watson, when you were naughty, you were Watson. And when you were good, you were Philip. But Watson, I'm going to see you tomorrow and I'll give you a punishment for what you've done. And the first evening, there was the fear of the punishment to come, which had upset him. But the following day at school, nothing had happened. The deputy head didn't seek him out. He didn't have a clue what was going to happen. And as a six-year-old, he was scared stiff. There was a real fear of what was going to happen to him. So I said, Phil, this is ridiculous. We'll go into school together and we'll go and see the deputy head and we'll get this sorted out. So we went into school together, went in quite early, and we knocked rather timidly on the door of the deputy head's office, and we went in, and I said, Philip, you explain. And Philip told the chap, said, sir, you were going to punish me yesterday for going to the sweet shop, and I haven't heard from you. And the chap could see the fear on my son's face. And he said, right, you've suffered enough because you've had 36 hours of worry. It's done. Go. And that was fair enough. And then having the boy out of the room, the deputy head said to me, "I owe you an apology. I'm very sorry. I completely forgot. I didn't remember anything about the threat to give him a punishment yesterday, and that shouldn't have happened." And actually, we got to know that school teacher very well indeed. He was an extremely good teacher. And the wise man is not someone who never makes mistakes. The wise man is someone who learns from his mistakes. And he apologized to me, and later on, to his great credit, he apologized to Philip for causing unnecessary and uncaring worry. Now, the punishment was deserved. He broke a school rule. He should not have gone to the sweet shop in his lunch break. But the fear engendered by the uncertainty of what was going to happen was not deserved. It was unreasonable. It was uncaring. Malachi, this book, makes it absolutely clear that God's judgment, God's punishment is there. It's there for everybody who breaks God's rules. But it also makes clear that the punishment is fair, it's just, it's deserved. And there isn't the fear of uncertainty that created so much trouble for us. I've really enjoyed this series on Paraclesis. I think it's a great little book. I've actually, at last, managed to finish filling it all in. I didn't get around to a lot of it till earlier on. If you haven't done it, can I suggest you do have a go? It really is worth it. There are still two or three copies at the back, so if you didn't pick one up, get one. It's really worth working through. Put that down there. But Paraclesis, we discovered, of course, means that, in essence, the one who is called to come alongside to help. The one who comes alongside to help. Now, that presupposes that you need help. That there's something where you need help, and you need to help the assistance of somebody else to sort it out. And for lots of people, they're very reluctant. There are times when I'm very reluctant to accept that I do need help. We learned a considerable lesson, Jean and I, very recently. We've just had a fantastic holiday. It was a special anniversary, and we celebrated by going on a great holiday. To quote Tim Vine, "Holiday once in a lifetime, never again." And that's certainly the case for us. We went by ship from Beijing to Singapore, visiting various countries, Korea, Vietnam, Bangkok, Japan, etc., on the way. Great fun. On the ship, there were about 2,700 passengers. It was huge. Of whom three quarters had white faces and came primarily from North America, from Britain, and from Australia. And about a quarter had brown faces and came from Korea and Malaysia and China. And it was fascinating to me that on the Sunday morning, there was a service on board the ship at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, so Jean and I went to it. And you know, we were the only white faces in the whole thing, although three quarters of the passengers had the faces the same color as ours. We were the only white people that bothered to turn up to the church service. And I was chatting afterwards to the crew member who'd taken the service and did it extremely well. He was a cop from Costa Rica, living then in the States. And I said to him, "Does this happen regularly?" And he said, "Yes, it's quite normal. The fact is that the churches in the developed countries, North America, Britain, Australia, etc., suffer from a great sin." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Complacency. They think they know it all. They don't realize that the spiritual momentum in our world has moved from people who have faces the colour of most of us here, the developed countries so-called, to the two-thirds world. Where is the church growing fastest today? It's not in Britain, and it's not in America, and it's not in Australia. It's in Brazil, and in Korea, and in parts of India, where there's a mass explosion amongst the Dalit people. We have to wake up to the fact that the world has changed, and there is a complacency about our church and our culture, which is actually quite frightening. Let me put it another way. Where are the places in the world which are now most open to the gospel? Where do you reckon there is a greater spiritual hunger? Where there is a spiritual vacuum because the old systems have been found wanting and don't work? The answer almost certainly is Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, all those countries that were part of the Soviet bloc, were nominally Muslim originally, but for 50 years lived under communism, and now are open. Do you know, I'd love to take you to a church in one of those countries this morning, which I know is meeting. It's a church in one of those countries I just named, and they have nothing 10 years ago. There was no church there. Now they have between 300 and 400 teenagers every week worshipping in the church. How's it happened? Well, through the Spirit of God primarily, but in human terms it's happened because a young guy from Birmingham who was at Bible college and had a real calling from God to go to that part of the world where he knew there was a spiritual vacuum. And he said, how do I do it? Now, like me, he was a football nut. He watched that funny game played with a round ball most Saturdays, which is the only sport that is universal throughout the whole world. So he took the trouble to get all his football coaching badges. He got the whole lot, right up to being a grade one referee. And because he had all those coaching badges, he immediately got a visa to go into that country. And he started a football club 6 years ago. And now they have 300 plus teenagers in their church every Sunday. Fascinating, isn't it? If you want to get into that country, there are two ways of getting visas. One is to become a teacher of English as a second language. And the other one is to become a football coach. And they're crying out for people able and willing to do that. Now, you don't think of football coaches as, quote, missionaries, unquote. But that's the world in which we live. That's where the real spiritual vacuum is in today's world. Let me give you another example. On Friday, that's just the day before yesterday, the Bible Society put out a fascinating press release, which I read with great interest. And there's one city in the world where suddenly the Bible Society has been inundated with requests for Bibles and portions of Scripture. I was frankly gobsmacked when I saw the identity of that city. I wonder if you're guessing which one it was. You know where it is? It's Aleppo in Syria, where there is mass destruction and people are in real fear of their lives. These are the places where there is a real spiritual vacuum. What are we doing to meet it? I didn't even know the Bible Society had a representative in Aleppo, but they do. And he has distributed last week and this week, 5,000 children's colouring books of the Nativity story, and he's launched an appeal to find the money for 25,000 Bibles, which he will give away to people in Aleppo. If I ask you to name the story by Jesus which best describes the way we should behave towards our neighbour, our people with whom we live, which story would you choose? Most of us would probably choose the story of the Good Samaritan. Jesus encouraging us to help the person in need. But if you think just for a moment about that story of the Good Samaritan, who were the people who failed to help? Who looked at the chap wounded by the side of the road and did nothing about it? They were the churchgoers, the priest and the Levite. I haven't moved away from the topic of God's punishment, God's judgment. The story of the Good Samaritan reminds us that God's judgment comes heavily on those who are complacent, like those churchgoers, the priest and the Levite were, who saw the guy in trouble and did nothing about it. Now, I very much doubt whether there's anybody in this room who ought to go and qualify as a football coach and go off to Kyrgyzstan or Turkmenistan to teach soccer. If you'd like to, that's great, and I can give you 30 jobs tomorrow. But for most of us, that's irrelevant. Yet, is it? How involved are we, both as individuals and as a community, with the places in this world where there is real spiritual hunger, where there is a vacuum because the old systems have collapsed and new ones need to put into their place? I'm actually quite unashamedly putting a challenge to all of us at St. Mary's Borough Heath this morning. If we're to avoid God's judgment on our complacency, or on our unwillingness to get involved with the people that are really hurting, then I think all of us ought to think about getting involved perhaps with one part. You can't do it all. None of us can do that. But we can all get involved with one church, one country, one setup. If you want detail on how to do that, I'll be very glad to help afterwards or in weeks to come. But I think there is a real challenge to us. Many people today in Global Connections, which is the Evangelical Missionary Alliance, are arguing passionately that in the 21st century, the guy wounded by the side of the road, as in the story of the Good Samaritan, are the Syrian refugees or the people in Yemen. And there is a real spiritual vacuum in those areas which the Christian Church is doing very little to meet. And Malachi says the people who don't care or don't do something to show that they care will face the judgment of God. There's no compromise. There's no exceptions. It's actually very tough stuff. Lesson number one we talked about from punishment is that God does punish. He judges. And if you're guilty, there's no excuse. We won't spend quite as long as the other lessons. Because lesson number two is from that reading that Hilary read to us. It's Malachi 3, verse 6. I've got it underlined in my Bible from a long time since. I, the Lord, do not change. God is utterly consistent. His teaching, his judgment, but his mercy and his love are consistently the same. Now that's completely contrary to the spirit of our age. We live in a world that does not believe in absolute values, but only relative ones. Our world is full of changing attitudes and opinions and values, but God isn't like that. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. A few weeks ago, I was invited to take part in a debate at NESCOT. NESCOT, many of you all know, is the College of Further Education in Epsom and Sutton. And they had a debate, and the topic was, there is no absolute truth. And Muggins was asked to oppose that motion, which I duly did. But it was fascinating that almost all the students there didn't believe that there was anything absolute about goodness or truth. I remember the chap on the other side was a student, very articulate, highly intelligent man, but I got his exact words. He sort of jabbed me on the chest and said, everything is changing. Nothing is the same. The values you observed when you were a student 50, 60 years ago are totally different from the values that we observe today. Our opinions on sex, on money, on marriage, on relationships with the opposite sex, and relationships with the same sex are completely different now. We have different views on lifestyle. Now, I'm not going to expand that now. We haven't got time. But you and I have to think about that. One of the lessons from Malachi is that God is consistent. He doesn't change. And the third lesson, fundamental to the teaching of Malachi, is the concept of covenant. Started with Abraham, the covenant between God and his people. But you know, what you and I often forget, at least I do, is that covenant is not just a one-on-one relationship. It is that. It's a covenant between God and me as an individual, but it's also a covenant of the relationship between God and me as part of a community. And we are a community that need to have a living relationship with God and work together to put things right in the world in which he's placed us. There's a wonderful section in Psalm 67 and Psalm 68 which run together, and I'm going to close with these. I think this sums up the covenant relationship and the way we should relate. Psalm 67, verse 2. The prayer is that your ways, God, may be known on earth, your saving health among all nations. I love that. Saving health among all nations. And how is it achieved? Well, Psalm 68, verse 6 tells us, God sets the lonely in families. Isn't that fantastic? God sets the lonely in families. That's true locally in Borough Heath, but it also needs to be true in Aleppo and in the Yemen. And, of course, in Kathmandu and in Mombasa and wherever. Our job is summed up in Malachi 4, verse 2. You who revere my name, for you, the Son of Righteousness, will rise with healing in his wings. That's the promise of God. The Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in his wings. Amen.